The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from The Week magazine this week, dated May 11th, 2012. And thanks so much for joining me today. We'll begin with the main story section of The Week magazine. Our first article is entitled, A Chinese Dissident Shames the Regime. What happened? A blind Chinese legal activist embarrassed China and thrust its brutal treatment of political dissidents into the international spotlight this past week after he staged a daring escape from house arrest and took refuge at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing. Chen Guangcheng's six-day stay at the embassy triggered a tense diplomatic standoff between Washington and Beijing, which ended with the activist agreeing to leave the diplomatic compound after receiving assurances of his safety from China's government. U.S. officials said that the deal would allow the self-taught lawyer to reunite with his wife and two children and to enroll in a university to complete his legal studies. Making these commitments a reality is the next crucial task, said U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who arrived in Beijing for pre-scheduled talks with Chinese officials just as Chen was released. But Chen, whose crusade to expose forced sterilizations and abortions had infuriated the government, said he only agreed to deal because Chinese authorities warned that his wife would be beaten to death if he stayed at the embassy. The activist fled his home in the eastern province of Shandong last month after 19 months of beatings and illegal house arrest. Under the cover of night, he scaled a 7-foot-high wall authorities had built around his house and was spirited to Beijing by an underground railroad of friends and supporters. Liu Weimin, foreign ministry spokesman, demanded that the U.S. apologize for taking Chen into the embassy and give assurances that such incidents will not recur. Now here's what the editorial said. Americans can be proud that Chen sought refuge in the U.S. Embassy, said CSMonitor.com. Despite a perception that it is headed toward decline, the U.S. still represents a beacon of freedom and human rights in China. Activists like Chen are not drawn to the U.S. for support and protection because of America's economic and military might. Rather, it is the moral attraction of America's ideals. Excuse me. We must remember those ideals during our dealings with China, said the New York Times. Although the U.S. needs the country's cooperation on North Korea, Iran, and matters of global trade, our government should remind China's autocrats that this embarrassing tug-of-war over Chen would never have occurred if they didn't deny their people the most basic rights. Now here's what the columnist said. Sooner or later, China is likely to renege on its end of the bargain, said Susan Glasser in foreignpolicy.com. Its officials have only promised that the human rights campaigner will be treated humanely, but that doesn't rule out putting him back under de facto house arrest. There was also no word on the other human rights activists rounded up for helping Chen escape. Only the American officials urging the authorities to take no retribution against them. The U.S.'s failure to demand a better deal could have long-term repercussions inside China, said Michael Auslan in NationalReview.com. The White House's display of apparent weakness will not only discourage those fighting for freedom, openness, and human rights in China, but could also embolden the regime to greater repression. That's unfair to the Obama administration, which was ultimately powerless to help Chen, said Max Fisher in TheAtlantic.com. Diplomats could have offered Chen permanent asylum, but there's no way they could have reached his wife and child, who were being guarded by police. Chen is free for now, but the Chinese government clearly feels that it has lost face. He and his family will be in continuing danger. Still, Chen has succeeded in delivering a powerful blow against China's ruling elite, said Peter Foster in The Telegraph in the United Kingdom. The battered but indomitable activist brought the cruelty of China's one-party state to global attention. It's almost hard to believe that the vital economic relationship between China and the U.S. could be held ransom by one blind man. But the fact that a single, solitary human voice can bear witness to the plain truths that powerful nation states too often choose to ignore should give ordinary citizens of the world cause for hope and quiet rejoicing. Our next article from the main story section of the week this week is called Drone Attacks Stepped Up. In a major expansion of his program of targeted assassinations, President Obama has authorized drone strikes on suspected al-Qaeda militants in Yemen, even when the exact identities of the targets aren't known. Unnamed officials told the Wall Street Journal that the CIA and the military are now selecting targets based on their intelligence signatures, which comprise information from aerial surveillance and human sources. Signature strikes will be allowed when there is clear indication that an al-Qaeda member is present. Such strikes have been used in Pakistan for years, and after Obama's approval, officials said the first one was carried out in Yemen last week. This is the first time that the Obama administration has officially acknowledged its drone program. The United States government conducts targeted strikes against specific al-Qaeda terrorists, White House counterterrorism advisor John Brennan said this week. As a result of our efforts, the United States is more secure and the American people are safer. In fact, there's no evidence that drones make us any safer, said James Joyner in TheNewRepublic.com. Willy-nilly targeting of low-level militants is quite likely to do more harm than good. Signature strikes, the government says, kill 10 of the top 20 terrorists in Pakistan, but striking unnamed people we only suspect are militants radically ups the risk of killing innocents, which in turn produces legitimate anti-American anger that terrorists recruiters can exploit. The collateral damage in Pakistan was so great that the strikes ultimately backfired, turning much of the population against us. Drones will never wipe out al-Qaeda anyway, said Greg Shoblete in RealClearWorld.com. They just make them relocate. See the pattern? The U.S. drove al-Qaeda from Afghanistan. They set up in Pakistan. It drove them from Pakistan. Now they are in Yemen. It should be clear by now that there's not going to be a death blow here. There could be, but only if the Obama administration commits enough resources, said Seth Jones in the Wall Street Journal. Al-Qaeda's territory is now broader than ever, encompassing an arc from North Africa to the Middle East and South Asia. This is where U.S. forces, especially clandestine special operations, intelligence units, and law enforcement, must play a critical long-term role. Drones are one tool in that effort, but they won't be enough by themselves. Our next article from the main story section is Easing Student Loan Costs. The federal student loan program became the latest battleground in President Obama's reelection campaign as Republicans buckled under intense pressure and voted last week to extend a 3.4% interest rate rather than let it double. The existing $6 billion subsidy to federal student loans was due to expire in July, pushing the rate to 6.8% and saddling 7 million undergraduates with an average of $2,800 more in interest. Obama made congressional Republicans' refusal to retain the subsidy a theme in several speeches on college campuses last week. House Republicans finally passed a bill extending the measure for 1 year, but insisted it be paid for through cuts to Obama's signature health care law. Their bill is likely to fail in the Senate, where the Democratic majority wants to finance the subsidy by ending tax breaks. This frenzied bipartisan panderfest to student voters is shameful, said Frederick Hess in NationalReview.com. The subsidy in question is a middle-class entitlement whose expiration would cost students only $25 extra a month at most. It's discouraging that Romney and the GOP chose to match Obama pander for pander. Given the state of the economy, said Jordan Weissman in TheAtlantic.com, it's worth extending this subsidy to give students a break, at least for another year. But let's not mistake it for any kind of solution to college affordability. Tuition fees are at record highs, and total student debt is $1 trillion. Instead of bickering over interest rates, we should be devising more efficient teaching methods that educate more students per dollar. The problem here is not just college's expenses, said Frank Bruni in the New York Times, but its newly uncertain returns. Even a degree in philosophy or anthropology was once a reliable engine of social mobility. But today it's all but useless. Subsidies might be better spent steering students toward degrees that will actually get them jobs. We use taxes to influence behavior. Why not student aid? And now we'll turn to the controversy of the week and the Week magazine. It's entitled, Bin Laden, Does Obama's Boasting Cross the Line? Is Barack Obama trying to become the most polarizing president since Richard Nixon? Asked the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. In his re-election campaign's most controversial TV ad yet, former President Bill Clinton praises Obama's cool courage in ordering the raid on Osama bin Laden's compound a year ago this week. That victory lap is tasteless enough, but the ad goes further, questioning whether GOP challenger Mitt Romney would have had the guts to do the same. The evidence for this scurrilous attack? Romney's 2007 statement that it's not worth moving heaven and earth spending billions of dollars just to get one person. And his criticism that same year of Obama's promise to go into Pakistan to kill terrorists without that country's consent. Romney later clarified that the U.S. should, of course, search for bin Laden, predicting he will die. The desperate Obama team, however, chose to cherry-pick his quotes. With the economy still in shambles and Obamacare unpopular, the killing of bin Laden is the only thing this president can campaign on. Imagine that, a politician so cynical he'd politicize national security, said Michelle Cottle in TheDailyBeast.com. Of course, that includes every frickin' Republican who has run for office since 2001. The Republican Party, let's not forget, spent most of a decade boasting that President Bush and the GOP had kept us safe, even though 9/11 occurred on their watch and raising the specter of terrorists at the door if a Democrat ever won an election. Obama earned the right to boast, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. The decision to send SEALs into Pakistan to kill bin Laden was hardly a no-brainer. The CIA had put the odds of Osama even being in the compound between 40 and 60%. Obama's top advisors, including Defense Secretary Robert Gates, were recommending a safer but less conclusive B-2 bomber or drone attack. The president overruled them at his own immense political risk. If that kind of calm judgment under pressure isn't something voters should consider in November, what is? It certainly doesn't give Obama the right to lie, said Conor Friedersdorf in TheAtlantic.com. When Romney criticized then-candidate Obama's pledge to violate Pakistani airspace to take out terrorists, Romney only questioned the wisdom of making the pledge so publicly. Besides, if any president deserves credit, it's George W. Bush, said former CIA interrogator Jose Rodriguez in The Washington Post. It was Bush's decision to send captured terrorists to CIA black sites for enhanced interrogation that led us to bin Laden, policies that have since been denigrated by Obama as unproductive and contrary to American principles. That's a lie by a war criminal trying to justify his direct participation in torture, said Andrew Sullivan in the DailyBeast.com. The U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee reviewed millions of pages of evidence and concluded that torture did not lead us to bin Laden. Republicans are now freaking out because Bush and Cheney failed to get bin Laden over seven thuggish years, while Obama, a liberal, rightly takes credit for dumping his carcass in the sea. Say what you will about Obama, said John Meacham in Time.com. He's proved time and time again to be a steely commander-in-chief with a real killer instinct. He's turned foreign policy from a Democratic weakness into a Democratic strength. And the ferocious, sputtering Republican reaction is proof positive that they know it. Now from the main story section, we'll turn to the popular section entitled A Good Week For and A Bad Week For. It was a good week for bragging after Vice President Joe Biden told a tittering audience that President Obama has a big stick, I promise you. The assumption was Biden was referring to President Theodore Roosevelt's famous quote, "Speak softly and carry a big stick." It was a good week for begging after New Jersey Governor Chris Christie said that Mitt Romney might be able to convince me to join him as the vice presidential nominee on the Republican ticket, despite his love for New Jersey. He's a convincing guy, explained Christie. And it was a good week for ordering the salad after a new report found that cars driven by Americans are burning up almost 1 billion additional gallons of gas a year because so many of us are overweight. And it was a bad week for Italians after the government's recent crackdown on tax evaders netted the nation a whopping $7.9 billion in owed taxes. Some stores and businesses failed to file any tax returns at all, saying they simply forgot. It was a bad week for tempting fate after Australian billionaire Clive Palmer announced plans to build the Titanic II, a modern version of the infamous ocean liner with a launch date of 2016. It is going to be designed so it won't sink, Palmer said. And it was a bad week for too much information after the National Zoo in Washington, D.C. live-tweeted the artificial insemination of its giant panda, Mei Zhang, noting that doctors are inserting a thin tube about 12 inches into Mei filled with sperm. A link to a photo followed, tweeted a follower, "Ew." And now we will turn from Good Week For and Bad Week For to the People's section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first article here is entitled Van Halen's Stage Fright. Eddie Van Halen has always been terrified of performing, said David Curtido in Esquire magazine. When he was 7 years old, his family immigrated from the Netherlands to Pasadena, California, and Van Halen was recruited into his father's wedding band. It wasn't like, "So what do you want to do in life?" says the rock guitarist. Dad said, "We've got to make a living. If it weren't for music, we wouldn't have survived." The young Van Halen was a musical virtuoso, but would shake with nerves whenever he faced an audience. At age 12, he asked his dad how he could conquer his stage fright. His father handed him a shot of vodka and a Pall Mall cigarette. "And I go, 'Oh, this is good. It works.'" He spent much of the next four decades in an alcoholic haze. "For so long, it really did work. I would do blow and drink. Then I'd go to my room and write music." Van Halen sobered up in 2008, but still misses the crutch that booze provided. It does enable you to lower your inhibitions. At the same time, it also gives you a false sense that what you're doing is great. "Now I'm so afraid of everything that sometimes I'm afraid to pick up the guitar," said Van Halen. The next article from the People's section is called The Man Who Hacked Hollywood. Chris Cheney used to be a celebrity cyberstalker, said David Kushner in GQ. In 2008, the 33-year-old loner was browsing the Internet when he came upon a leaked, half-naked photo of Miley Cyrus, stolen from her own email. Cheney wanted to know how the hacker had gotten into her account. I was like, how hard could this be, he says. By guessing celebrities' email addresses and doing some basic internet research to answer password security questions, often the names of their pets, the unemployed Floridian accessed hundreds of stars' accounts. He says he found shots of a well-known actress in her mid to late 40s posing naked and messages suggesting that some leading men were batting for the other team. Cheney became obsessed with cracking accounts and rarely slept. It's the whole Star Trek thing, going where no man has gone before. He kept his hacking secret for 2 years, but in 2010, I let my curiosity and I think my marijuana get the best of me. He leaked nude shots of singer Christina Aguilera and actress Scarlett Johansson online, but didn't cover his digital tracks. Cheney was arrested last year and now faces up to 60 years in jail. I'm glad they arrested me because I wasn't going to be able to stop this on my own, he said. Bonham Carter's full disclosure. Helena Bonham Carter is unusually frank about intimate matters, and Camilla Long in the Sunday Times in the UK, just 3 months ago after she gave birth to her second child, Nell, Bonham Carter went back to work on the Harry Potter films, even though her pelvic floor was so weak that she peed all over the seat. I couldn't jump up and down without losing most of my bodily fluid, she says. They had these air dryers, huge things. That's where I'd dry myself off. Eventually, she resorted to diapers. The girls on the set were like, how can you? But actually, I don't think I was too embarrassed. There's something quite liberating about having a baby. There's less, you know. She waves her hands about everything. Bonham Carter is amazed that Nell came along at all, as her child was conceived during a low point in her 11-year relationship with director Tim Burton. You have to have sex to get pregnant, don't you? She asks. Bonham Carter only realized she was pregnant when a costumer pointed out that her breasts had exploded like jello, so she must have had sex at some point. Yeah, that's what I can't remember, she says. No, we did do it once. And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for this week. Now we'll turn to the briefing section. And this week's article is entitled Egypt's Uncertain Path. The first presidential election since last year's revolution will be held this month. Will it lead to real democracy? Who rules Egypt now? The military does, in an uneasy rivalry with the country's most powerful Islamist group, the Muslim Brotherhood. The Supreme Council of the Armed Forces took control when the 30-year regime of Hosni Mubarak was brought down in February of 2011 after 18 dramatic days of public protest. Under the leadership of former Defense Minister Mohamed Hussein Tatawi, the junta at first took several popular actions, repealing the repressive emergency laws of the Mubarak era, releasing political prisoners, and organizing last November's parliamentary elections. But it has also tried thousands of protesters in military courts, failed to prosecute police who fired on protesters during the revolution, and shown a stubborn will to regain control. What about the Muslim Brotherhood? It is now the largest political party in parliament, thanks partly to the millions of dollars the military funneled to it ahead of the November elections. Analysts believe the military backed the Brotherhood as a bulwark against secularists who were demanding a fully democratic system and civilian control over Egypt's large and opaque military budget. But relations between the military and the Brotherhood have deteriorated badly since the elections, Islamists have spearheaded new protests in recent weeks, voicing fears that the junta will not let any democratic force, including Islamists, exercise real authority. The military might accept the Brotherhood as an ally within the new political space, says political scientist Ashraf El-Sharif of the American University in Cairo, but it will not tolerate a brother on top. Does the Brotherhood want a theocracy? It says it does not. After dominating the parliamentary elections, the Brotherhood promised to respect the rights of Coptic Christians, secularists, and women, and not to run a candidate for president. But a few months later, it reneged on that pledge and nominated the popular Karat El-Shater, who said that introducing Sharia law would be his first and final objective as president. The Brotherhood's change of heart has been seen by some as an attempt to outflank the even more conservative Salafists, who took 25% of the seats in Parliament on a fundamentalist platform calling for strict segregation of the sexes. A Salafist president would certainly pull Egypt toward theocracy. Under either the Brotherhood or the Salafists, Egypt would have a more overtly Islamic government than it did under Mubarak. Will the election be free? Not really. Last month, the election commission, still controlled by Mubarak appointees, used technicalities to disqualify half the presidential candidates planning to run in the May 23rd, 24th elections, including El-Shater and two others considered frontrunners. The Brotherhood's leadership is now backing its second-choice candidate, Mohamed Morsi, but he lacks El-Shater's charisma. The Salafists last week threw their support behind a more moderate Islamist, Abdel Monaim Abolfoto, who broke away from the Brotherhood last year. He also has support among liberals and is likely to do well. But a split in the Islamist vote could boost the candidacy of Amr Moussa, a suave former foreign minister and ex-head of the Arab League who draws some support from secularists, but is also mistrusted as a filul, or remnant of the Mubarak regime. The top two finishers in this month's first round will run off in mid-June. The winner is expected to take office on July 1, when the military council is to step down. What will the military's role be then? That's anybody's guess. There's no new constitution yet, and the military's demand that one be in place before the election is unlikely to be fulfilled. The new parliament appointed a 100-member commission to write a constitution, but it stacked the commission with Islamists, prompting loud complaints from secularists, minorities, and women, the very people who helped lead the revolution. A court has disbanded the commission and ordered parliament to appoint a new one, but the delay means that Egypt could have a new president before anyone knows what his powers will be. As the various Islamist groups and the military conducted a prolonged power struggle, it looks as if there will be a little voice for the secular youth and the women who led the revolution and hope to create a new Egyptian society. Why were the activists left behind? Unlike the Islamist group, secularists lack the political infrastructure to field candidates and turn out voters in the November parliamentary elections. Women in particular have been sidelined. The parliamentary quota system for women in place under the Mubarak regime was abolished, resulting in a 508-seat legislature with just 8 female members. Not surprisingly, the abuse of women that caused so much international outrage during the revolution has continued. In December, police ripped the clothes off of one female protester. Footage of that attack prompted a massive women's protest in Tahrir Square, but no political consequences. Activists say that despite a democratic veneer, Egypt's new government will retain oppressive control over its citizens. We are definitely now living under a military coup, said activist Shadi El-Ghazali Harb, and the whole world should know it. And the footnote to this briefing is entitled, U.S. Aid Flows On. Under Mubarak, Egypt was one of the biggest recipients of U.S. military aid, provided largely to reward and support the country's non-belligerent stance toward Israel. That aid will continue despite growing discomfort in Egypt over the 1979 peace accord with Israel, and despite growing concerns about Cairo's respect for human rights. Late last year, Congress voted to recommend restricting this year's $1.3 billion of military aid, a demand some lawmakers renewed early this year when Egypt arrested 16 American pro-democracy workers. But in March, the State Department released the aid, saying that canceling existing defense contracts would cost $2 billion and jeopardize American jobs. Many in Congress were not pleased. It sets a precedent that America will not punish its aggressors, said Rand Paul, a Republican from Kentucky, but instead gives them billions of our taxpayers' dollars. Now, from the Week magazine for this week, let's turn to the best columns in the United States, as determined by the editors of the Week magazine. Our first column is entitled, Who Really Controls Washington? By Robert Samuelson in the Washington Post. The conventional wisdom is that Washington is controlled by corporations and the rich, said Robert Samuelson, but federal spending proves that this wisdom is wrong. Over the past three decades, annual spending on the top 10 federal programs for the poor and the near poor, such as Medicaid, food stamps, and Pell grants, soared from $126 billion in inflated adjustable 2011 dollars to $626 billion. Today, the average poor person receives $13,000 in federal aid, up from $4,300 in 1980. Programs that transfer wealth to the middle classes are even more massive, with Social Security consuming $725 billion last year and Medicare $560 billion. All told, Uncle Sam spends nearly $2.1 trillion on social programs, 60% of all federal spending. That's not ignoring the will of the people to favor the rich. In fact, the real Washington is in the business of pleasing as many people as possible, which is why our budget deficit has ballooned out of control and our tax code is such a mess. Fixing what's wrong would require simple common sense and some shared sacrifice. Sadly, our system rewards both parties for taking the path of least resistance. The next article, or the next column, I should say, is The Vatican's Reprimand of the American Nuns by Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times. Nuns rock, said Nicholas Kristof. The female clergy of the Catholic Church are among the bravest, toughest, and the most admirable people in the world, truly embodying the teachings of Christ in their selfless work with the young, the poor, and the sick. Yet the Vatican recently delivered a stinging rebuke to American nuns, chastising them for focusing on poverty and social justice rather than joining the male hierarchy's obsession with abortion and gay marriage. What Bible did that come from? Jesus commanded his followers to feed the poor and embrace the outcast. He said not a word about homosexuality or abortion. Who is more Christ-like, the pampered Pope in his white silk cassock and red Prada slippers, or the nun working the line in a ghetto soup kitchen? Nuns are tough, too. In my world travels, I've seen heroic nuns face down warlords, pimps, and bandits. One nun, Sister Rochelle Facera, even shamed 200 armed soldiers of African warlord Joseph Kony's army into releasing a group of kidnapped girls. So, Pope Benedict, all I can say is, you are crazy to mess with nuns. The next column, An Election That Has a Familiar Ring, by Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. It's 2004 all over again, said Jonathan Chait, Once again, the presidential race pits a rich guy from Massachusetts with a reputation for flip-flopping against an incumbent president with middling approval ratings. The parallels go further than you'd think, and it's hilarious how the two parties have changed places. In 2012, Republicans are bitterly complaining about Obama giving campaign-style speeches on the taxpayer's dime, but were distinctly less outraged when George W. Bush used Air Force One on a record number of campaign stops in 2004. Back then, the GOP-funded attack ads sneering at John Kerry's luxury yacht and Nantucket mansion. Now, when Democrats level broadsides at Romney's wealth, it's vicious class warfare. But Democrats are at Romney's wealth, but Democrats are hypocrites, too. In 2004, they were indignant over how Bush politicized 9/11 and the war on terror. This year, they applaud Obama's boasting that he killed Osama bin Laden. But come on, Democrats show the GOP some sympathy. Remember how galling it was to watch Bush relentlessly exploit the presidency to boost his own campaign while ruthlessly tearing down his opponent? That's how Republicans feel now. And now we'll flip to the back of the week magazine for the section called The Last Word. And the article this week is entitled, George Zimmerman's World, When a Crime Wave Struck a Gated Community, says Chris Fakascani, one resident decided to take a stand. A pit bull named Big Boy began menacing George and Shelley Zimmerman in the fall of 2009. The first time the dog ran free and cornered Shelley in their gated community in Sanford, Florida, George called the owner. The second time, Big Boy frightened George's mother-in-law's dog. Zimmerman called Seminole County Animal Services and bought pepper spray. The third time he saw the dog on the loose, he called again. An officer came to the house, county records show. Don't use pepper spray, he told the Zimmermans, according to a friend. It'll take 2 or 3 seconds to take effect. But a quarter second for the dog to jump you, he said, get a gun. In early December, the couple trained and licensed bought guns. George picked a Kel-Tec PF-9 9mm handgun, a popular lightweight weapon. By June 2011, Zimmerman's attention had shifted from the loose pit bull to a wave of robberies that rattled the community, called the Retreat at Twin Lakes. The Homeowners Association asked him to launch a neighborhood watch, and Zimmerman began to carry the Kel-Tec on his regular dog-walking patrol. On February 26th, George Zimmerman shot and killed unarmed black teenager Trayvon Martin in what Zimmerman says was self-defense. The furor that ensued has consumed the country and prompted a reexamination of guns, race, and self-defense laws enacted in nearly half the United States. Zimmerman's detractors defined him as a vigilante who had decided Martin was suspicious merely because he was black. After Zimmerman was arrested on a charge of second-degree murder more than 6 weeks after the shooting, prosecutors portrayed him as a violent and angry man who disregarded the authorities by pursuing the 17-year-old. But a more nuanced portrait of Zimmerman has emerged from a Reuters investigation into his past and a series of incidents in the community in the months preceding the Martin shooting. The 28-year-old insurance fraud investigator comes from a deeply Catholic background and was taught in his early years to do right by those less fortunate. He was raised in a racially integrated household and himself has black roots through an Afro-Peruvian great-grandfather. Though civil rights demonstrators have argued that Zimmerman should not have prejudged Martin, one black neighbor of the Zimmerman said recent history should be taken into account. Let's talk about the elephant in the room. I'm black, okay, the woman said. She leaned in to look at a reporter directly in the eyes. There were black boys robbing houses in this neighborhood, she said. That's why George was suspicious of Trayvon Martin. George Michael Zimmerman was born in 1983 to Robert and Gladys Zimmerman, the third of four children. Robert Zimmerman Sr. was a U.S. Army veteran who served in Vietnam in 1970. Zimmerman Sr. also served two tours in Korea and spent the final 10 years of his 22-year military career in the Pentagon, working for the Department of Defense, a family member said. In his final years in Virginia before retiring to Florida, Zimmerman Sr. served as a magistrate in Fairfax County's 19th Judicial District. Gladys came to lead a small but growing Hispanic enclave within the All Saints Catholic Church parish in the late 1970s, where she was involved in the church's outreach programs. Gladys would bring young George along with her on home visits to poor families, said a family friend, Teresa Post. Post recalls evening prayers before dinner in the ethnically diverse Zimmerman household, which included siblings Robert Jr., Grace, and Dawn. It wasn't only white or only Hispanic or only black. It was mixed, she said. Zimmerman's maternal grandmother, Christina, who had lived with the Zimmermans since 1978, worked as a babysitter during his childhood, caring for two African-American girls who ate their meals at the Zimmerman house. They were part of the household for years, Post said. Zimmerman diligently served as an altar boy at All Saints from age 7 to 17, church members said. At 14, he became obsessed with becoming a Marine. At 15, he worked three part-time jobs to save up for a car. After graduating from high school in 2001, he moved to Lake Mary, Florida, a town neighboring Sanford. His parents purchased a retirement home there in 2002, in part to bring Christina, who suffers from arthritis, to a warmer climate. On his own at 18, George got a job at an insurance agency and began to take classes at night to earn a license to sell insurance. He grew friendly with a real estate agent named Leanne Benjamin, who shared office space in the building, and later her husband, John Donnelly, a Sanford attorney. George impressed me right off the bat as just a real go-getter, Donnelly said. He was working days and taking all these classes at night, passing all the insurance classes, not just for home insurance, but auto insurance and everything. He wanted to open his own office, and he did. In 2004, Zimmerman partnered with an African-American friend and opened up an Allstate insurance office, Donnelly said. Then came 2005 and a series of troubles. Zimmerman's business failed, he was arrested, and he broke off an engagement with a woman who filed a restraining order against him. That July, Zimmerman was charged with resisting arrest, violence, and battery of an officer after shoving an undercover alcohol control agent who was arresting an underage friend of Zimmerman's at a bar. He avoided conviction by agreeing to participate in a pretrial diversion program that included anger management classes. In August, Zimmerman's fiancée at the time, Veronica Zuazo, filed a civil motion for a restraining order alleging domestic violence. Zimmerman reciprocated with his own order on the same grounds, and both orders were granted. The relationship ended. In 2007, he married Shelley Dean, a licensed cosmetologist, and in 2009, the couple rented a townhouse in the Retreat at Twin Lakes. Zimmerman had bounced from job to job for a couple of years, working at a car dealership and a mortgage company. He enrolled in Seminole State College in 2009 and was one credit shy of graduating when the shooting occurred. By the summer of 2011, Twin Lakes was experiencing a rash of burglaries and break-ins. Previously a family-friendly, first-time homeowner community, it was devastated by the recession, and transient renters began to occupy some of the 263 townhouses in the complex. Vandalism and occasional drug activity were reported, and home values plunged. One resident who bought his home in 2006 for $250,000 said it was worth only $80,000 today. At least 8 burglaries were reported within Twin Lakes in the 4 months prior to the Trayvon Martin shooting, said the Sanford Police Department. Yet in a series of interviews, residents said dozens of reports of attempted break-ins and would-be burglars casing homes had created an atmosphere of growing fear in the neighborhood. In several of the incidents, witnesses identified the suspects to police as young black men. Twin Lakes is about 50% white, with an African-American and a Hispanic population of about 20% each, roughly similar to the surrounding city of Sanford, according to U.S. Census data. But it was the August incursion into the home of Olivia Bertalan that really troubled the neighborhood, particularly Zimmerman. On August 3rd, Bertalan was at home with her infant son while her husband Michael was at work. She watched from a downstairs window, she said, as two black men repeatedly rang her doorbell and then entered through a sliding door at the back of the house. She ran upstairs, locked herself inside the boys' bedroom, and called a police dispatcher. Police arrived just as the burglars who had been trying to disconnect the couple's television fled. Shelley Zimmerman saw a black male teen running through her backyard and reported it to police. After the police left Bertalan, George Zimmerman arrived at the front door in a shirt and tie, she said. He gave her his contact numbers on an index card and invited her to visit his wife if she ever felt unsafe. He was so mellow and calm, very helpful and very, very sweet, she said. People were freaked out. It wasn't just George calling police. We were calling police at least once a week. In September, a group of neighbors, including Zimmerman, approached the Homeowners Association with their concerns, she said. Zimmerman was asked to head up a new neighborhood watch. He agreed. Police had advised Bertalan to get a dog. She and her husband decided to move out instead and left 2 days before the shooting. Zimmerman took the advice. He'd already had a mutt that he walked around the neighborhood every night. Man, he loved that dog. But after that home invasion, he also got a Rottweiler, said George Rodriguez, a friend and a neighbor of the Zimmermans. Less than 2 weeks later, another Twin Lakes home was burglarized, police reports show. 2 weeks after that, a home under construction was vandalized. The Retreat at Twin Lakes e-newsletter for February 2012 noted, "The Sanford PD has announced an increased patrol within our neighborhood during peak crime hours. If you've been a victim of a crime in the community after calling police, please contact our captain, George Zimmerman." On February 2nd, 2012, Zimmerman placed a call to Sanford police after spotting a young black man he recognized peering into the windows of a neighbor's home, according to the neighbors. "I don't want to approach him personally," Zimmerman said in the call, which was recorded. By the time police arrived, according to the dispatch report, the suspect had fled. Then on February 6th, the home of Tatiana DeMakis was burglarized. Two roofers working across the street said they saw two African-American men lingering in the yard at the time of the break-in. A new laptop and some gold jewelry were stolen. Police found DeMakis' laptop in the backpack of 18-year-old Emmanuel Burgess, police reports show, and charged him with dealing in stolen property. Burgess was the same man Zimmerman had spotted on February 2nd. 3 days after Burgess was arrested, Zimmerman's grandmother was hospitalized for an infection, and the following week his father was also admitted for a heart condition. Zimmerman spent a number of those nights on a hospital room couch. 10 days after his father was hospitalized, Zimmerman noticed another young man in the neighborhood acting in a way he found familiar, so he made another call to police. "We've had some break-ins in my neighborhood, and there's a real suspicious guy," Zimmerman said, as Trayvon Martin returned home from the store. The last time Zimmerman had called police to report Burgess, he followed protocol and waited for police to arrive. This time, Zimmerman was not so patient. "These assholes," he muttered in an aside, "they always get away." After the phone call ended, several minutes passed when the movements of Zimmerman and Martin remain a mystery. Moments later, Martin lay dead with a bullet in his chest. This article was copyrighted in 2012 by Thomson Reuters, all rights reserved, and it was reprinted with permission. And now from The Last Word in the Week magazine, we'll turn to the Talking Points section. Our first article here is entitled, President Obama, the Coolness Factor. Even his critics have to admit it, said Brian Montepulli in CBSNews.com. President Obama is cool, while his opponent, Mitt Romney, just isn't. And lately, the president has been doing all he can to emphasize the coolness gap between himself and his stiff, awkward opponent. Last week, he appeared on NBC's Late Night with Jimmy Fallon to slow jam over a blues riff about his student loan plan. Then came the White House Correspondents' Dinner, at which Obama joked about being drunk-texted by Hillary Clinton, name-dropped rap star Young Jeezy, and jauntily acted like the hip alpha dog he is. That prompted Republicans to come up with a new line of attack on Obama, said Howard Kurtz in the DailyBeast.com. He's too cool. Karl Rove's American Crossroads Super PAC made Obama's slow jam the centerpiece of an attack ad, snidely calling him a celebrity and asking, has 4 years of a pop culture POTUS made anyone's life any better? That's pretty desperate, since when is hipness a political liability? Hip is fine, up to a point, said Kathleen Parker in the Washington Post, but when Obama went on Fallon's show, playing straight man, as Fallon called him, the Prezi of the United States, it felt just a little bit unseemly. Obama may be as cool as ice tinkling in the glass, but Americans don't want their president acting like a goofball with a late-night comedian. Is anything beneath the dignity of the Obama White House, said James Toronto in WSJ.com. Obama spends far too much time clowning around with sycophantic celebrities, singing pop music, pandering to college students, and launching into sneering attacks on Republicans who disagree with him. The man has no class, and people are starting to realize it. Are conservatives getting a hipness complex? Asked Adam Sorensen in Time.com. They should stop fretting. Look, Romney will never be cool, but that won't matter one bit if swing voters believe he's a sober economic turnaround artist. As for Obama, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com, there's a danger in being too cool. The defining factor of being cool, after all, is that you operate on a more refined plane than most people. Since many Americans already see Obama as an elitist, this isn't necessarily the sort of image you want to cultivate, especially during a prolonged economic downturn. The next article, Al-Qaeda, no longer a real threat? He was just one man, said James Kitfield in NationalJournal.com, but Osama bin Laden's death 1 year ago this past week at the hands of U.S. Navy SEALs clearly dealt a crippling blow to his Al-Qaeda network. The daring raid on that compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan, killed not just bin Laden himself, but the myth of his defiant invincibility, which lured so many Muslims into jihad. The U.S. also harvested a library's worth of intelligence from his compound. It's no accident that half of Al-Qaeda's top 20 leaders have subsequently been killed in raids and drone strikes. Awan al-Zawahiri, bin Laden's less charismatic successor, has been forced to lie low, said Greg Miller in the Washington Post. He's also narrowed Al-Qaeda's short-term ambitions towards smaller overseas attacks. As Chief Counterterrorism Advisor John Brennan put it, Al-Qaeda is now a shadow of its former self. The obituaries for Al-Qaeda are the product of wishful thinking, said Seth Jones in Foreign Policy. Even as it has lost many leaders from its core group, it has evolved into a decentralized organization of dozens of terrorist groups in Iraq, Yemen, Pakistan, Somalia, Nigeria, and other nations. Overall, the network has conducted more operations and killed more people since bin Laden's death than in the previous year, and is still determined to strike strike again in the U.S. Indeed, more than a dozen lone wolf individuals with ties to al-Qaeda have been caught in recent years trying to mount attacks on U.S. cities and infrastructure. And though so far they've been intercepted, it only takes one attack to be successful. Occasional lone wolf attacks won't produce the clash of civilizations that bin Laden hoped to trigger, said Michael Hirsch in NationalJournal.com. And today, Islamists have an alternative to violent jihad. The Arab Spring has provided new outlets for the frustrations of many of those who might formerly have rallied behind al-Qaeda. As they seek political power instead of glorious martyrdom, the Muslim Brotherhood and Salafist groups in the Mideast are cutting deals and moderating their extremism, and may even be forced to govern pragmatically. It will probably take many years, said Raoul Marc Gerecht in the Wall Street Journal, but democracy will get evolution rolling, undermine the theocrats, and result in bin Laden's worst nightmare, less angry relations between Islam and the West. And as we near the end of our program for this week, we'll take a look at a few shorter items here from the Talking Points section. The U.S. has sent a group of F-22 stealth fighter jets, the country's most sophisticated warplanes, to an airbase near Abu Dhabi, apparently to send a signal to Iran. 2 weeks ago, Iran agreed to negotiate over its nuclear future without preconditions. Another round of talks is scheduled for the week of May 23rd. Women who are more avid users of social media than men are, whether maintaining a personal blog, following a brand on Facebook, or creating a social network profile, the Nielsen Company has found women, for example, average 11 Facebook updates a week compared with 6 for men. The tallest skyscraper in New York City is now One World Trade Center, whose unfinished skeleton reached 1,271 feet this week, 21 feet higher than the observation deck at the top of the Empire State Building. When completed, the Freedom Tower, built to replace the Twin Towers destroyed on 9/11, will have 104 stories and a 408-foot needle that will make it arguably taller than Chicago's 110-story Willis Tower. And our poll watch for this week, public approval of the U.S. Supreme Court has sunk to a 25-year low. 52% say they hold a positive view of the court, down from 80% in 1994, and the lowest figure in the history of the poll, which began in 1987. And finally, when asked to name the best long-term investment, 28% of Americans say gold. 20% say real estate is the best option, followed by stocks, mutual funds, that's 19%, savings accounts and CDs, 19%, and bonds at 8%. And we've just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.